Good. So we started looking at this text last week. What I said last week was that I'm basing what I say on some talks that Suguti gave a few months ago on a retreat. And if you want to listen to the original talks, they're available on Free Buddhist Audio. If you search for Suguti 2011, then you'll see five talks on the Tiratna Vandana. Or you could just search for Tiratna. And they may come up, but they're on Free Buddhist Audio if you want to listen to the originals. And I recommend you do that, because we're not going to cover the material in the same depth as Suguti did, for lack of time primarily. And what we're going to do over the remaining 3 weeks, including today, is focus on the first third of the Tiratna Vandana, i.e. the Buddha Vandana, the salutation to the Buddha. The Tiratna Vandana is a traditional text, a traditional salutation to the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha. And in this seminar we're going to particularly focus on the Buddha jewel. So by exploring the Tiratna Vandana, in a way what we're exploring in more depth is what it is to go for refuge to the Buddha. What does going for refuge to the Buddha mean in practice? And who is the Buddha? Who is the Buddha that we're saying we're trying to go for refuge to? Who is the Buddha? When we say the Buddha jewel, what do we mean? And I said last week that this text is sort of really key. It's key because in the Pali Canon, certain words, certain verses from this text appear again and again and again. When the three jewels are described or praised in the Pali Canon, often in the words of the Buddha, then he uses words that are in this text. He uses descriptions of the three jewels that are in this text. And last week I was talking about one reference, which is a sutta called the Parinibbana Sutta, which describes the last days of the Buddha and his, in a way, last tour, where he's wandering around northern India, where he spent most of his life teaching. He's wandering around with a group of disciples, amongst them Ananda, his companion, and he's teaching the Dharma for the last time in each place that he wanders to. And in particular, he talks about the threefold path again and again and again. He talks about ethics, meditation, wisdom, sila, samadhi, prajna. And in that text, he's asked, in that Parinibbana Sutta, he's asked about the future destiny of various disciples that have died. Ananda asks him, because people ask Ananda. So they say, well, so-and-so was a follower of yours and died. What was his level of attainment, and where did he or she gain rebirth? And there's a whole list of names of monks, of nuns, of laymen and of laywomen who the Buddha says attained to some degree of transcendental insight. Either they became stream entrants, the very least of them became stream entrants, which means that progress on the path to enlightenment was assured for them in future lifetimes. So they could no longer fall back into states of suffering, states of woe, and progress was assured. So they gained a level of insight into the way things are that meant that from then on in, they couldn't but carry on moving towards enlightenment. That's what a stream entrant is. And we talked a little bit about that last week. But a stream entrant has still got a long, long, long way to go before they're fully enlightened. And there are other stages of attainment that are recognised, and the Buddha outlines all of them. So there's a stream entrant, there's a once returner that just has one more lifetime left, or non-returner that will attain enlightenment after this lifetime, or an arahant who is already fully enlightened in this lifetime. And what the Buddha, what he says is that he's going to give Ananda a teaching whereby Ananda or anybody else can tell for themselves whether they are a stream entrant or not, or whether somebody else is a stream entrant or not. And he calls this teaching the mirror of the Dharma, the mirror of the Dharma. And what he says is the test, the criteria that he gives in this sutta isn't a technical criteria. It's not that a stream entrant has achieved this or that realization. It's more an affective or emotional criteria. What he says is that a stream entrant would be somebody that has unwavering faith in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the Sangha. Unwavering faith in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And we looked at the words that were used, avecha pasadena, for unwavering faith. And we examined those words a little bit last week. And also, there's a fourth criterion, which is that they would have unblemished morality. So their practice of ethics, of sila, would be unblemished. They would have faultless kind of morality, which, as I said last week, for a stream entrant, that doesn't mean that they would always act completely skillfully. A stream entrant is still subject to craving and hatred, for example. So it's not that they're going to be able to act perfectly like a Buddha would. But if they did commit any act that was unskillful, they would feel an immediate need to confess it, to acknowledge it, to make amends, and make good, and to sort of carry on the path. So that's what's meant by unblemished morality in this context for a stream entrant. So you had four criteria: unwavering faith in the Buddha, unwavering faith in the Dharma, unwavering faith in the Sangha, and unblemished morality. And when the Buddha describes in the sutta what unwavering faith in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha would mean, he uses words that are here in the Tiratnavandana. So the implication is that if somebody could say the words of the Tiratnavandana with full full sort of unshakable conviction and full sort of veracity, then they would be a stream entrant. Yeah. So in a way, the Tiratnavandana becomes a central text for saying who's really a Buddhist, if you see what I mean. By really a Buddhist, I mean somebody who is really going for refuge, which means somebody who has sufficient insight into the true nature of things to not fall back. Yeah. So stream entrance. So the words of the Tiratnavandana, this side of stream entry, when we chant them, we're using them to try and build our confidence, our trust, our conviction. But a stream entrant would know them to be true. Would know them to be true from their own experience. They'd know that the Buddha was as described in this, the Dharma was, is as described in this, and the Sangha is as described in this Tiratnavandana. So really kind of key text, a central text to look at. And last week we looked at the first two lines of the Buddha Vandana. And I'll recap a little bit, and then we'll move on a bit, and then we'll have tea, and then I'll say a little bit more. And then, as we did last week, we'll break up into smaller groups where you can discuss things that I've said, or ask questions, or explore for yourselves in smaller groups stuff that I've been talking about. Okay. So last week we looked first of all at the first line, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. And I've spoke quite a bit about Namo, the first word, which is sometimes translated as salutation. Here it's honour to the Blessed One, honour. But what I was emphasising is something that Subhuti emphasised, was that the word salutation, even the word honour, is too weak for the actual connotations of namo. In Indian culture, even present-day Indian culture, but certainly the culture of the Buddha's time, reverence, salutation would have meant something much more strongly and heartfelt, strongly felt, than we're familiar with in our own culture. Namo would literally mean prostration, where you bow down with your feet, with your head to the feet of the Buddha. So you prostrate yourself. And that sort of prostration is common in India, even today, not just for great spiritual teachers, but for anybody that you look up to. So your elders, you would bow down to. Your parents, you would bow down to, in that sort of way. Traditionally, children would salute their parents in this way every morning. Every morning. I didn't do that in my own upbringing, Indian though it was. Although once a year we did used to, rather sort of begrudgingly, I'm afraid to say, but we did. And that's the sort of reverence that you'd naturally feel. Now, it's a traditional society where notions of hierarchy are still very much applicable. We've got a postmodern society where notions of hierarchy are much more difficult for us, they're complex, and we don't easily like to think of ourselves as bowing down to somebody higher than us. What I was arguing is that it's worth working with this emotion of reverence. Whether you literally bow down or not, it's worth cultivating a sense of reverence for the Buddha. Because unless we can see the Buddha as much, much beyond us, as somebody worthy of our reverence, then we're not really going to be able to go for refuge to him. And reverence is a really important human emotion to feel. Now, I wouldn't suggest that you start bowing down to anybody that you meet, but as far as the Buddha is concerned, I think we could do more of that. We could do more of that. And, of course, when we bow down to the Buddha, we don't have to use our imagination. He's not physically present as a living human being. But we can use symbols like the shrine. Or, you know, every time you walk into the shrine room, imagine that you're walking into a room which the Buddha lives in, that the Buddha's actually here. Use your imagination to cultivate this sense of reverence. It's a really worthwhile quality to cultivate. It implies a receptivity, a spiritual receptivity. And without receptivity, we're never going to be able to learn. We're not open to learning. I'll say a little bit more about that later on, the need for receptivity. So that was namo. That was namo. Yes, puja. Puja is a practice of receptivity, cultivating this reverence, isn't it? And then we looked at, so namo tassa is salutation to, or honour to. Bhagavato, we said, was this word that conjures up somebody who's auspicious and shining and radiant and fortunate and good to be around. Somebody that exudes this positivity that's more than just ordinary positivity. Subhuti talked about it almost like star quality. Some people just shine, they're radiant. The aura that's depicted around images of the Buddha is perhaps pointing to that sort of radiance. The Buddha was supremely attractive to be around, in the way that sometimes you just want to be around people. For us, probably in our culture, that sort of reverence and that sort of shining quality seems to be reserved for celebrities, doesn't it? And stars, actors and actresses and pop stars and royalty recently. And so they have the sort of... they're the people that we kind of often in our culture project this shining kind of quality onto. Well, the Buddha had that. The Buddha had that shining quality, that radiance, that positivity. And of course, it didn't come just because he was physically attractive. It came from his ethical purity and from his insight. It gave him an aura that was incredibly powerful and attractive to be around. So Bhagavato means somebody with that quality, in spades, as it were. In modern Indian language, it often means God. And so people can get confused and think that Indians who aren't Buddhists, who are Hindu perhaps, can think, oh, Buddhists are just worshipping a god like Hindus do. But actually, that's a later meaning of the word. It originally meant something like the quality that I've described. And similarly, arahato means somebody. It comes from a word meaning worthy, supremely worthy. Worthy because of their, in the Buddha's case, of his realization into the true nature of things, which made him free. So arahato has the connotation of somebody who's supremely worthy, and somebody who's conquered the defilements that hold us back of greed and hatred. But yes, it's primarily because of the Buddha's wisdom, his pranya, that he's given this appellation, arahato. And then sammasambuddhassa. And samma means something like complete or it's an emphatic that sort of means thoroughly, intensely, completely. And sum is a similar emphatic, so it means completely, really thoroughly. He is a Buddha. He is a Buddha which means that he's completely free, and he's discovered the way to that freedom for himself. That's the sort of cosmic function of a Buddha. So it's not just somebody who's enlightened, it's somebody who discovered the path to enlightenment without being taught that path to enlightenment. And they rediscover it, if you see what I mean, after the path to enlightenment has died out. So the Buddha has this sort of mythic cosmic function of rediscovering enlightenment in a place, in a time, where that path has been forgotten. So that was the first line. And then we had itipiso bhagava arahang sammasambuddho. And pretty much that means the same thing. So itipiso means it really is. It is this. We're emphasizing that this is true, as it were. It is so. Itipiso. So it's an emphatic statement. And then you've got these words again, bhagava, arahang, sammasambuddho, which mean the same as above. So you start with this salutation. Okay, probably what I'll do is I'll leave it there, and then I'll move on after tea to look at the next couple of lines. Very good, so let's move on. So the next line we're going to look at is Vijjacharana Sampanno Sugato. Vijjacharana Sampanno Sugato. And yes, that first word, that compound word, Vijjacharana Sampanno. So Sampanno is, it's a possessive. It means he who possesses, he who has. He who has the qualities of Vijjacharana. And vijja is a Pali word. The Sanskrit equivalent is sometimes more familiar. The Sanskrit equivalent is vidya. Vidya. Vidya is the Pali version of vidya. And it means knowledge. In modern Indian languages, it simply means knowledge. Knowledge in the ordinary sense of the word. But here, and in the Pali of ancient times, it means knowledge in a more esoteric sense. Knowledge that's particularly about the true nature of things. So the Buddha is said to have knowledge of the ways of the Dharma. He knows all the ways of the Dharma. He's said to be omniscient about the Dharma and the ways that one practices. So it's knowledge in a theoretical sense about not just the nature of reality, not just about enlightenment, but about how to practice so that you can move towards enlightenment. It's knowledge about methods. Do you see what I mean? Methods that then he can communicate to unenlightened beings. So it's knowledge about how to practice as well as knowledge about the way things are. So in this sense, it's doctrine, knowledge of the doctrine, but doctrine in the sense of how things are, and also doctrine in the ways of practice that lead to a realization of how things are. So vidya is about how to apply the Dharma in the world that we live in, how to apply it. It's an understanding of reality with knowledge of how to apply it. So in that sense, it's knowledge of a practical kind, if you see what I mean. And the Buddha is able to not only know how to apply it, but then communicate that. He communicates that to others. So that's vidya. Vidya. And charana. Charana is a word that's connected with our word career. It means something like there's something about conduct in the world. So what it's saying here is that the Buddha not only has knowledge of the true nature of things and knowledge of how to apply the Dharma, but he does apply it to himself. So he exemplifies what he's teaching. He has applied it to himself. His conduct is in keeping with what he's teaching. Yeah? He's an exemplar of what he's teaching. His conduct is in keeping with that because he's applied what he knows. So his wisdom is both sort of theoretical and practical, and he embodies that wisdom. He is an embodiment of that wisdom. So vidya charana sampanno. So he is one who possesses the knowledge of the Dharma and how to apply the Dharma, and he embodies that knowledge. He embodies the wisdom of that knowledge. And sugato. Are there any questions just about vidya charana sampanno? Does that make sense as to what I'm saying? Julie, yeah.
I just want
to
ask, maybe it's because I wasn't hearing this.
Sure.
Obviously, I noticed there's a translation on here on the right.
Oh, yes.
And that's... Is that a different to what you're saying?
No, it's similar. So this is equipped with knowledge and practice. Equipped with knowledge and practice.
Sorry.
So that's the line that we're reading.
Okay.
Yeah? So he who possesses that knowledge and... this is a translation by...
I wasn't sure.
Yes, it is a translation, sorry. Yes, I should have said. It's a translation that Bhante made. Yeah?
Can I ask about how do you attend? How do you
I'm just going to come on to that. So Sugato, Su is a prefix that can mean good, well, happy, wonderful, but here it particularly means happy. Yeah? Happy. And Gato means, I mean literally, it means going or gone to. So the Buddha is somebody who has happily gone to enlightenment. Yeah? Happily gone to nirvana. Or he's happily going. And here the translation is happily attained to nirvana, which is a freer translation. And I think it's just worth dwelling on, Subhuti was pointing this out as well, that he's happy. The spiritual life leads to greater contentment, greater fulfillment, a greater sense of satisfaction and peace. So it's not just knowledge and wisdom in a sort of dry sense. There's a happiness and a contentment that comes from knowing how things are. There's a contentment that comes from knowing that everything that we need to fulfill, to be fulfilled, is within us already. There's no need to look outside us for the fulfillment that we all search for. The Buddha, an enlightened being, would know that because they'd experience that fulfillment from within themselves. So there's no thing outside of themselves that they would be either grasping for or fearing. There's nothing that could shake them outside of themselves that could shake them from this wisdom. And that is a state of supreme fulfillment and happiness. It's the happiness that we all yearn for. It's the happiness, the deepest longing that we all have. And we all try and fulfil it, don't we? Everybody wants to be happy. And we all try and fulfil that yearning that we have for happiness in different ways. And the tragedy of human life is that so often we look for it in ways that not only won't completely fulfil, but so often just make matters worse. And that is the tragedy of the human situation, in a certain sense, this unfulfilled yearning for complete happiness. And of course Buddhism saying, how can that fulfilment come from something outside of ourselves that is also impermanent? How can it come from something that, because it's impermanent, can't be relied upon? How can complete fulfilment come from something that is unstable, that's unpredictable, that's not to be relied upon? Even if a temporary fulfilment can come, a complete fulfilment won't come from anything conditioned. I also like to think that, in a way, that the human heart can't be fulfilled by anything finite. How can something finite in the world ever fulfill what's really a longing for the infinite, for something that transcends space and time and our body and anything else that we can imagine in this world? How can, you know, the yearning that we look for is a sort of for an infinite fulfillment, if you see what I mean. We look for it in possessions that are finite. We look for it in people that are finite and impermanent. And we look for it in, things like status and all sorts of other things, don't we? That as soon as we have them, we sort of realise, don't we? We probably realise even in advance that they're not going to be it. But nevertheless, we can kind of yearn for it. And we get sucked in, don't we? We get sucked in because the world around us tells us that that is where happiness is to be found. And the world around us doesn't point us to Buddhahood and tell us that there's an alternative. So I can remember, before I was a Buddhist, thinking, look, I kind of know that all these things won't really fulfill my career, or looking for love, or pleasure, or sex, or food, or money, status, power. I kind of knew that they weren't it, but I kind of also thought, well, I can't think of anything else. Do you see what I mean? What else is there? And I sort of knew that there ought to be, but maybe I wasn't going to be able to find it, so maybe I should just settle for those worldly things. And coming across the Dharma was like both a relief and a challenge. It was a relief because finally I was being taught some things that I thought, yes, they really do point to complete satisfaction and fulfillment. I intuited that they were true. What tiny experience I had of them confirmed that intuition. But then there was a challenge as well, because if I was to look for happiness in the Dharma, in the Buddha, then I was going to have to let go of my grip on happiness from worldly sources. Do you see what I mean? If true happiness was going to be found in going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, then that was going to have implications for my life. And there was a challenge in that. And there is a challenge in that still for me and for all of us. There's a challenge in that. We have to kind of meet that challenge as best we can. We have to kind of meet it as best we can by trying to deepen our going for refuge, by trying to shift the emotional weight from worldly things that might give us temporary pleasure to something that's actually within us and genuine and beyond conditioned existence, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and to the Sangha. And that's a shift that happens gradually, and that's what going for refuge to the three jewels is all about. It's about making that shift, that reliance that we have on things. It's trying to make that shift so that we rely more and more on the values embodied in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's what going for refuge is about. And when we do that, to the extent that we can do that, we start to experience what true fulfillment, true contentment, true happiness feels like, looks like. Now, of course, this side of enlightenment is not going to be complete, and it won't be always with us. We can approach it. We can become happier. We can become happier. Now, sometimes when I teach here, I say that Buddhism isn't about becoming happy. And I kind of have a different point in mind. I have a point about Buddhism being about transcending ourselves so that we can experience the way things really are. And sometimes that transcending ourselves, going beyond ourselves, isn't comfortable. It's not comfortable. So when I say it's not about being happy, what I kind of mean is it's not about being comfortable. It's not about pleasure. It's not necessarily about easy happiness. What it is about a more genuine contentment and fulfillment that comes from following something that we know to be true. Yeah. So that's the distinction that I sometimes make. So happy is an ambiguous word, isn't it? And I'm happy when I'm lying in my bed, well past when it's time to get up. I'm happy of a sort. It's not the same happiness that a Buddha is experiencing. Yeah. So yes, the Buddha is happily attained, happily gone, happily going, as it were.
Can I ask about the happily attained?
Mm.
Does it mean looking at the tenses there?
Right? Yes.
Because I can sense of as he was in the process of attaining this.
Yes.
There was happiness and a kind of a surrender and, you know, the lack of that kind of resistance that I experience anyway.
Yeah.
That kind of, as if he really gave himself to it, which is such a relief and brings him
happiness. Yes, I think you could read that in. But then also he has attained now and he's still happy. Yeah. So there's both in a certain sense. I think there's happiness of the path to attainment and there's happiness of the attainment. There is a certain happiness when we know that, yes, at last we've found something that is meaningful in our lives and that goes beyond all the trivia that we can so easily get sucked into. There's a fulfilment from that. But then there's a greater fulfilment when we actually do attain to realizations about the true nature of things. And the true nature of things isn't outside of us, it's also the true nature of ourselves. So we realise who we really are, and there's a liberation and a fulfilment that comes from that liberation. So he's both, in that sense. So I think that's quite important to emphasise, because the spiritual life isn't necessarily about grimness. Do you see what I mean? It doesn't have to be grim. There can be, in fact, I mean, it might have periods where it's difficult and challenging, and the Buddha said that the spiritual life is one of the hardest things that human beings could do. To aim for enlightenment is the hardest thing that a human being can aim for. Bandhi says that it's much easier to become President of the United States, for example, than to become enlightened. And he says that it'll take all the energy and all the commitment that we've got to reach this goal. So it's not that it's easy, but it doesn't have to be grim. It doesn't have to be grim. And my experience is one of the things that really makes it a pleasure, even a delight, is sangha. Is friendship, is to be in the company of others who are also trying to develop greater awareness, greater compassion, greater metta. There's a joy in living from ideals with other people who are sharing those ideals. There's a delight in that, I think. So it doesn't have to be true. Okay, so that's sugato. So we've had vicha-charana sampanno, sugato. Then we come on to this word loka-vidu, which here is translated as knower of the worlds. So loka is world. We've got lots of retreat centres that are called something loka. So there's Tara loka, or Tiratna loka, or Padma loka. And loka means realm or world. Or sphere. And here it means world in the sense of reality. It means that it's like the different worlds, the different planes of existence. It means that all the different worlds that there are, both literal, as it were, but also worlds like, the world of the arts, or the criminal world, as Subhuti used in the example. There's these sort of psychological and cultural worlds that exist. I sometimes think in Bethnal Green, there are all these worlds going on in sort of parallel to each other. Do you see what I mean? You can walk down the road and encounter all these different worlds, people in different worlds, even though they're on the same Roman road. But also worlds in the sense of spheres of existence, no, planes of existence. So Buddhism says that this material plane isn't the only plane of existence. There are worlds of pure form. A world of pure form is called the rupa-loka, archetypal form. And then there's the arupa-loka, which is the formless world. The world that we normally think of as the world of form, is called the karma-loka. Now, whether we take those karma-loka, rupa-loka, arupa-loka literally or not, certainly what Buddhism is saying is that this material plane isn't the only plane of existence. There are all these different planes of existence and these different worlds. And vidu means Well, it's connected with, etymologically, it's connected with seeing. In the sense of really seeing, seeing through, penetrating into, seeing, understanding, and knowing. So the Buddha is the knower of the worlds. He's seen all the worlds. He's seen through to the essence of all the worlds. He's seen through them because he's seen that all the worlds that there are have at their heart the same characteristic, which is that they're conditioned. They arise and they cease, independence upon condition. They're conditioned, they're transient, they're phenomena that are constantly changing, they're impermanent, and that there's no substance behind them. He's seen that. He's seen the essence, or the essencelessness, if you like, of all worlds, of all conditioned existence. So Subhuti makes the point that sometimes people say, oh yeah, the Buddha, you know, he knew the world of his day. He knew what it was like to be alive in 5th century BC India. But he wouldn't understand our 21st century postmodern world in the West. And Subhuti was saying, no, he would. He didn't experience it. Of course he didn't experience it, and he may not know about the contingent details of it. But in essence, he would understand it, because it's still a conditioned existence. And human beings are still driven by the same forces of craving and hatred and delusion as they always have been. Yeah? And they still have the potential for liberation, as they always have had. So he would understand our world in its essence, in its essential characteristics, just as much as he'd understand any other world. Yeah? Any other world. He knows us. He knows us. And we flatter ourselves if we think that we have progressed so far that he wouldn't know us. He knows us. He knows us. He knows the issues that arise from craving. He knows the suffering that arises from craving. He knows this. He knows the conflicts that arise when more than one person craves. When peoples together crave for happiness, he knows conflicts can arise. He knows the hatreds that we can feel and where that can lead. So he's a knower of all worlds.
Last question. Is it true to say then, because often we feel not understood?
Yes.
And we feel that our suffering is very particularly impersonal to ourselves.
Yes.
Actually, it's very global.
Yes, and universal and global. And of course the particularities are unique. The circumstances are different for each of us. So in a sense that's true. But the more fundamental bases of suffering are the same for all of us. All of us. And if you look deeply enough, you see that. You see that. We all want to be happy. We're all being frustrated from complete happiness by getting things that we don't want, not getting things that we do want. We're all mortal. We're all subject to death, sickness, loss. All of those fundamental truths are universal. Yeah, so Lota Vidu. It's said that he... After his enlightenment, the Buddha spent, according to the texts, several weeks in the vicinity of the tree under which he gained enlightenment. He spent 7 weeks, it's said, in that vicinity, absorbing the experience of enlightenment. So, for example, for a week, I mean, seven is a sort of mythical number, so it might have been who knows how long it was. But it's said that for a week, he moved to another spot where he could sit and look at the tree, the Bodhi tree, which he gained enlightenment under. And he sat there with reverence and gratitude to the tree for having sheltered him during his enlightenment. And if you go to Bodh Gaya, the spots are marked. So there's this tree where he's said to have gained enlightenment. Then there's another spot which has a plaque by it that says, well, this is where he sat and gazed at the Bodhi tree. And it's said that in the fourth week after his enlightenment, he sat in the Ratnagar. Now, Ratna means jewel and Gar means house. So he sat in a jewelled house, which must be the jewelled house of his imaginal faculty, of his imagination. He sat in the jewelled house of his mind and surveyed the worlds, surveyed all realms of conditioned existence. And that's when he became knower of the worlds, Lokavidu. In the fourth week after his enlightenment, he surveyed all of conditioned existence and knew it fundamentally. Okay, a little more, and then we'll break up into groups. So Anuttaro, perhaps we'll just leave it with Anuttaro. Anuttaro, it's read as being part of the next set of words, Purisadama Sarati. So sometimes it's Anuttaro Purisadama Sarati. Sometimes the Anuttaro is taken on its own. And I'm going to take it on its own here. Un is a negative prefix. So not, as it were. Uto means utmost, as in our word utter. Yeah, so uto means utmost, or topmost, or supreme. So anuttaro means without anything higher. So he is anuttaro, Buddha, the Buddha is anuttaro, so for he is for somebody for whom there is nothing higher, yeah, than himself, as it were. He is the highest being. He is the highest a being can be. He is the supreme being. So this is really, really important, because when we go for refuge to the Buddha, as the Buddha, not just as a another teacher amongst lots of teachers, the Buddha is the highest being that there can be. He is the highest that a being can be. So it's not that there's something higher like a god, or potentially an even higher being. No, the Buddha is as high as any being can be, by definition, if you see what I mean. Almost. That is what a Buddha is. He is the highest being. Because of his attainment. What he's attained to is more mysterious to talk about. And in a sense, you could say that what he's attained to, reality itself, is even higher. But as a being, the Buddha is as high as a being can be. In a way, he's become an embodiment of that reality. So he is as high as a being can be. And in that sense, he's in a class of his own. He's sort of transcended ordinary humanity. Bhante talks about him as being like another species almost, because of his attainment. And yet, all human beings are capable of that same attainment. So he's not like Christ was said to be the Son of God. the Buddha was a human being who attained to the highest that not just a human being, but any being could attain. And that potential is within us all. So in the Buddhist scriptures, sometimes some of the Hindu gods are talked about and referred to. And their mythology is sort of included, but they all, in these Buddhist texts, they all look up to the Buddha. They all worship the Buddha. So, what's being said here is that the highest gods that Hinduism can conceive are disciples of the Buddha. There's nothing higher, no being could be higher. So I think that's just important for us to take on board, because as I say, it can be tempting for us to, in our culture, where hierarchy is a difficult and complex thing sometimes, it's sometimes tempting to think, well, the Buddha was just another very good human being. And there are lots of very good human beings from different religions and different cultures, and it's wrong to single somebody out as the highest. Apparently I was told a story of somebody who went to a Buddhist conference in America, and somebody at that conference said that somebody who's a Buddhist said that they didn't agree with the fact that the Buddha was the highest attained. He was just differently attained. Yeah, he was differently attained, not higher. And it was wrong to think in terms of anybody being higher, because, of course, all the problems that can lead to. And we know of all the problems. But, of course, in knowing of all the problems that hierarchy can have, we can dismiss the very notion of anybody being higher than us. And, as I say, if we do that, then we cut off the spiritual path for ourselves. True wisdom begins when we know that we don't know everything. True wisdom starts with a not knowing, a conscious not knowing, and a knowing that there's something that we need to learn, and that there are people that we might be able to learn that from. So it's really important, this, that we have a healthy, or try and have a healthy relationship with the Buddha as the highest, the supreme being. At the same time, that doesn't mean that we're worthless. Just because the Buddha is fully enlightened and the highest being that they can be, that doesn't mean that we don't have worth. Yeah, it's easy to get into one of those polarities of either nothing is higher than I am, or I'm completely worthless. And both those positions are based on neuroses. A healthy human response would be to say, no, I do have some worth, I have self-worth, I'm a human being, and that doesn't mean that I can't learn and grow. I'm not there yet. Do you see what I mean? That's what we're trying to move towards, is a healthy response that can look up without feeling that completely annihilates us. So maybe we should leave it there and have a chance to explore this material in smaller groups, and just focus on the words that we've explored so far, and see what questions come up for you, or disagreements, or whatever. Yeah.